and welcome to Radio Shalom. I'm Deb Levy, and today I'm here talking to Dr. Natalie Flynn about her new book, Smart Mothering. For those who tuned in last week, you'll know that Natalie is a psychologist, a mother of three, a member of the Auckland Hebrew Congregation, and the author of this fabulous new book. And Natalie, thank you so much for coming back and talking to us more about your research.
Thanks so much for having me.
We had a chance to explore a little bit of the journey that led you to writing this book last week. And today I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about how we've got to the world we're in today, where mothers are constantly bombarded with an overload of information that can be completely overwhelming and often contradictory as well.
Yeah, it's really crept up on us, and particularly, you know, over recent years with social media. Anyone that's got an opinion and can type, well, they're free to do so. And, of course, it's the most emphatic groups or individuals that take to social media. And when you think about it, I mean, my parents and my grandparents had a different set of issues that they dealt with. It wasn't so much bombardment stress. You know, they really had one or two books to rely on. One that is mentioned a lot is Dr. Benjamin Spock's The Common Sense Book of Baby and Childcare.
Yes, everyone knew Dr. Spock.
Everyone knew Dr. Spock. It was baby care in your home, mm-hmm. I think is what he said. Mm-hmm. And so people either went it their own way. You know, of course, they might have had some anachronistic advice from relatives, but really it was the mother, the father, Spock, and some relatives.
It's true, and it's quite a big contrast when you look at having kind of the influence of one expert versus a whole range of different experts and offering contradictory advice, and to have maybe a group of women who were telling you their experiences or opinions to the entire world sharing their journey online.
And of course, part of the difference is now, you know, I have so many mothers coming to me, and intellectually they know what they see on social media isn't how it really is. But viscerally, it's really hard when they've got baby vomit all over them and food around the kitchen. And right there on their social media feed is a beautifully groomed woman with twins heading to do Pilates. And they know that that's not really how it is, but it still can really spiral them down.
Yeah.
So there's that part to it as well.
The fact that we're presented with a world that isn't really real when it comes to parenting, and then we're experiencing the realities which aren't exactly glamorous or pretty.
That's right. And when social media, in a way, it finds them in their own home, there's no escape. So it's not like the old days where if you didn't want to see the Joneses, you wouldn't go to their house.
Yes. Yeah. Now the Joneses come right through your phone into your bedroom.
They do, and with no cracks. I mean, even at the Joneses, eventually the mother might look tired and grumpy.
Yes.
But not on social media. She often looks shiny and fresh all day.
And one of the things I really enjoyed about your book is there are plenty of examples, you know, from people who are honestly sharing the fact that they're struggling and the real life experiences of mothers who, you know, can't present this perfect picture all the time because no one can.
No, exactly, and nor should they have to. And something that I really emphasise in the book is knowing when you need to go for help.
Yes.
Not being afraid to accept help. So many women have, mothers have barriers to that. You know, the watching the I shoulds, that I should be able to do this alone. Who says you should? Up until recent times in human history, we lived in cohorts of about 15 people. There were aunts, there were uncles.
Yeah.
And
a village raised a child.
Absolutely. So, you know, why should we do this ourselves?
And yet, historically, a lot of the shoulds have come from research and experts and scientists, psychologists, and just thinkers who have put forward their ideas as the be-all and end-all of parenting. And I wondered if we could go into a little bit of the history of that, because I think that helps us understand how we've got to these kind of, these polar places today of baby-centered or parent-centered and kind of the grey areas in between.
That's right. So, so much of what's happening today with current parenting styles is basically when I talk about extreme parenting.
Mm.
So when I talk about extreme parenting, what I'm really talking about is a parenting style that puts huge pressure on the parents, particularly women, or has a prescriptive set of rules mm-hmm. that need to be followed. These extreme parenting styles come from good ideas and good theories, but they've gone rogue. So they've taken a good theory, which is based on truth, such as babies need maternal and paternal care,
mm-hmm.
that maternal and paternal deprivation is high risk for a baby's outcomes. And so these extreme parenting styles have taken a good idea and then extrapolated from that nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, for example, that if a baby isn't in human contact 24/7, that amounts to maternal deprivation, or at least the outcomes are the same as. And that's really, if women want to do that, then no harm done. Of course there's no harm in a baby, for example, having human contact.
Mm.
But 24/7.
Yeah.
Except bed sharing, of course, has its own risks.
Yeah.
But for mothers to feel that they're doing something wrong if they don't follow a particular parenting style, that's just a shame.
So with these extreme parenting styles, I like that you call them that, because it really means that anything that is taken to the absolute extreme, whatever the theory is problematic.
Can I say it's only problematic if it's exhausting for the mother? You know, again,
nice.
I will say bed sharing does have its own risk, but putting that to one side, I don't really know of many parenting styles that are dangerous to the baby, but the problem is if it puts undue stress, and when I mean undue, I mean stress that's not actually based in fact.
Yeah.
On a mother.
So it's one thing if, as mothers, we are experiencing some stress in order to do things that are really beneficial for our babies, you know, like, for example, if they're hungry and they need feeding and we're tired. But actually, we don't need to be killing ourselves trying to follow a rigid set of rules in an extreme parenting style to the detriment of our health, when it's not an essential for the baby. It's a nice to have or something that could be helpful.
And the research is, and you'll find when you read the book, that the research is actually very, it's guiding, but it's also very reassuring. There are plenty of different parenting styles that you can use and still do the best for your baby. So whether it's parent-led or baby-led or breast or bottle, as long as you take care of yourself and you tune into your baby's cues, try and understand what they need from you. You don't need to get that right every time. We can't.
Yeah.
And then respond to them in a warm and sensitive way.
Mm-hmm.
If we also are a good fit for them, that means get to know their temperament and accept them for who they are.
Mm-hmm.
That you've got it covered.
You used a beautiful term last time. You said good enough parenting, which I really liked. You know, that actually there's no such thing as perfect parenting. And what we need to be aiming for is good enough, that we're meeting our baby's needs as much of the time as we can, and also looking after ourselves at the same time.
Absolutely. And you don't need to get it right every time. You're not always going to know what your baby wants.
Mm-hmm.
We just need to stay calm and try and figure it out.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And so watch out for information or advice that tells you that if you don't follow a certain parenting technique, then there will be a wide raft of detrimental outcomes.
Yes, and particularly if they start referring to like long-term devastating consequences.
Absolutely.
I think that's a very good signal for parents that actually you may be being sold an extreme parenting style.
That's right. And okay, again, if you want to do extreme parenting, absolutely fine, as long as it doesn't tax you to the point that your emotional health is drained.
Yeah, because no one wins.
Because then no one wins, absolutely. So, you know, and also on the other side of that, if someone is offering one technique, say a sleep technique, and from that promising a wide sweep of advantages, mm-hmm. watch out for that too, because the subtext really is, well, if you don't do this, then the flip side is disadvantages.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get away from all of the guilt.
Yeah, there's a lot of guilt in parenting, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. To give birth is to feel guilty.
Yeah. I've heard the same thing said about being Jewish, actually.
Absolutely. But, it, you know, it's. I remember someone saying, you don't need to be Jewish to be a Jewish mother.
Yeah.
I know what they mean.
It's true. I think in today's day and age especially, there's so many guilt-inducing messages out there for mums. And it'd be good to have a chance to talk about that a bit later on. But for a start, could you take us through a little bit of the research history?
Sure. So would you like a bit of the research history about, again, attachment and
yeah, well,
what are you after?
One of the
particular?
Things I loved reading your book was that you did some myth busting about the difference between attachment, healthy attachment, and kind of attachment theory and parenting styles. So if you could explain a little bit about that and how has that come about? Because it's very confusing, I think, for young mums particularly, or any mum who's trying to grapple with what these terms mean and what the implications are for their own personal parenting.
Yeah, and thanks for bringing this up. This is a bit of a bugbear of mine, really. Mm-hmm. The confusion between attachment theory and attachment parenting. Again, I'm not against attachment parenting at all, as long as the mother does it because she enjoys it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want mothers to confuse it with attachment theory, and often they do. So attachment theory is John Bowlby's theory,
mm-hmm.
and it emerged really in the early 50s. His theory is that babies are born with a drive, a biological drive to attach, and from birth they show attachment behaviours, which makes sense, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And so initially this was just a theory, but thanks to Ainsworth, who met up with Bowlby years after he came up with this theory, she gave his theory scientific proof through what we call the strain situation procedure.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the strain situation procedure.
Yeah, so Ainsworth, and she's brilliant, another one of my idols. So she first studied babies in Uganda, mother and baby pairs.
Mm-hmm.
And she studied them for a long time and had a look at maternal behaviours and how that played out with the mother-baby relationship. And then she moved to Baltimore, and what she did was this. So the strain situation procedure basically takes a mother-baby pair, and the strain situation is in an office outside the home,
mm-hmm.
and then it looks at different things such as how the baby responds when the mother leaves the room, how the baby responds when the mother comes back. So it has a look at how they relate to each other. And from that, Ainsworth and later Mary Main came up with four different attachment styles or patterns.
Mm-hmm.
What we really love is to see a secure attachment between a mother and a baby, where the baby explores and, you know, goes back to their mother mm-hmm. for security.
And we do see that all the time at the
absolutely.
Playground, where kids kind of run along, look back and check, run along, look back and check, and there's
yeah.
a little, like, invisible line almost of that circle, that area of how far they're willing to go, and then just
exactly.
check back in with that attachment.
Yes, and people have called that since the circle of security.
Beautiful.
Yeah, moving away from a mother to explore, feeling confident that you're being watched over and then coming back.
I feel like as a 33-year-old, I still do that sometimes.
Absolutely. Oh, yes, I'll be ringing my mum after the show.
Yeah. It's good to have a circle of security.
Absolutely. We all need that mm-hmm. in our relationships.
Yeah.
You know, in our romantic relationships too.
Like when you go to a party and you split off and talk to other people, but you might be aware of where your partner is in the room if you feel like you need to connect again.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's interesting that you raise that, because attachment styles and patterns, for research purposes anyway, can be quite predictive
mm-hmm.
of the way that babies grow up and form later relationships.
So to put it in another word, the relationship that you have with your primary attachments, like your mother or your father, can then influence on your romantic relationships and the way you interact with your friends, your partner, and other adults in your life.
The way that you see yourself mm-hmm. in the world and the way that you see other people in relation to you. Now, what I want to say is, you know, because I kept up to date with the research, is that she also uncovered insecure attachment. I want to make sure that mothers don't get frightened and don't read up on this and think, oh, my baby did this or that. They must have an insecure attachment. You know, these words are really for research purposes or for clinicians to decide when they see a parent-baby pair. Also, babies that do have insecure attachments, you know, that's pretty normal too.
Yes. It's all on the spectrum of the different types of parent-child relationships that are going to occur.
Yeah, so, you know, secure attachment is the gold, but insecure attachments can be fine too. What we need to be, what we're very aware of as clinicians are what we call a disorganized attachment, and that's something quite profound.
So mothers shouldn't get confused with these terms. That an insecure attachment is still an attachment. It's just a different type of attachment.
Well, they're all attachments, but mothers should be careful to not read up on an insecure attachment and then pathologize their relationship with their baby or what that means.
Okay.
So, you know, so be careful around this. Now, with so that's attachment theory. Basically, just the truth of it is that babies are born with a biological drive to attach to a primary caregiver and that it's important for them long term, and that maternal deprivation or paternal deprivation can have negative outcomes. And so Ainsworth proved that in a way, you know, turned his theory into a science. Now, what has happened is that that has been misrepresented many times throughout history. In fact, Bowlby himself, about the only broadsheet that he sent out, I think it was sometime, I can't remember, 50s or 60s, he became worried because mothers, after reading about attachment theory, were becoming too alarmed to leave their babies. And he was saying, no, I'm talking about maternal deprivation. You can go out for dinner. It's good for you.
Yeah.
So now we go forward to attachment parenting.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of, for somebody who's just looking at a parenting style, what are some of the kind of examples of when you're looking at attachment parenting? What might you see?
Yeah, so attachment parenting really came to life with the Searses.
Mm-hmm.
So they are parents of many children and one had colic, and they were looking for ways to, of course, soothe their colicky baby.
Mm-hmm.
So from this, what they're talking about, and when people hear attachment parenting, it's being with your baby 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
So that's bed sharing, being in constant contact with your baby, breastfeeding on demand, no crying at all for the baby. So, you know, again, none of this is a bad thing to do, but it can put enormous stress on mothers in particular. And what's worrying is that when people confuse the truth about Bowlby's theories and Ainsworth's work with attachment parenting, it can really frighten mothers if they're just not up for doing that.
Yeah, because it is a hugely demanding parenting style, you know, and unless a mum is really enjoying it.
Absolutely, and some mothers do.
Yeah.
And lovely. But if you're not enjoying it, know that attachment parenting isn't grounded in research.
Yeah.
Attachment theory. Well, the theory is not the parenting style. And in fact, when Jeffrey Kluger, who's a journalist, looked into Sears and had a look at who Sears was citing to bolster his attachment parenting views, he wrote quite an extensive article because of, I think it was about four studies that Sears was relying on. Three of them were animal studies.
Yes.
And one or two studies when Kluger, the journalist, contacted the original researchers. They were really upset that Sears was using their research to promote attachment parenting. So one of them said, look, I wrote a paper on serious parental deprivation and abuse. Sears cannot use that to try and show that babies are harmed by, small amounts of crying.
Yes, yeah. And the other thing I really enjoyed is that you actually went into a bit of detail about the Sears family themselves.
I really like that family.
Tell us about the Sears family.
I mean, I don't like that people are being frightened if they're not up for attachment parenting, mm-hmm. but they just seem like a really lovely family. And what really strikes me is they have a number of children that they parented quite differently, mm-hmm. but all of them seem to be, most of them at any rate, it doesn't really matter how the Sears has parented them, attachment or not attachment parenting, they've all grown up to be people who seem to be very interested in community and, and have done very successful things in
their life. Active contributing members of our society.
That's right.
Because my understanding is that initially with their parenting, between study and work, they both weren't as available as one would need to be for attachment parenting.
Oh, absolutely. And, and when you think about it, in fact, so they had a number of children, and the first ones, yes, they were working, and the children were sometimes in the care of a nanny.
Which doesn't really fit with attachment parenting at all, does it? That there'd be those kinds of absences or those gaps between when the child had that full-time contact and care.
Yeah, absolutely. So when they first had the first few children, the father, William Sears, was still studying,
mm-hmm.
and Martha was the breadwinner, working 3 days a week, while the kids were looked after by a caregiver. And then their fourth child arrived.
Was this the colicky baby?
It was. Things really changed dramatically. She had colic, and they were desperate, as all parents are, to find a solution.
Mm-hmm.
And it was around that time that Martha became aware of Jean Liedloff's theories.
Ah, the continuum concept.
The continuum concept. And so they committed themselves to around-the-clock proximity to their daughter, Martha carrying her in a sling. They had her in bed with them at night time. And William started writing on the subject with Martha's help. Then four more children soon came along. And
wow.
An adopted daughter, I know. But, so what's interesting is, I've asked the question in my book, did putting the elder three children in childcare, making them sleep alone, not carrying them around and letting them cry sometimes impair their intellectual development or cause antisocial behaviour? No, it didn't.
No.
They all seemed to be quite wonderful children.
Because interestingly, in some ways, the first few children grew up in a completely different family with a completely different parenting style than the later children.
Well, I would say that they grew up in the same family but with a very different parenting style.
Yeah.
And the reason probably that they came up so well, they're great genes, probably wouldn't hurt, but they had loving parents.
Who were good enough.
Who were good enough and that didn't depend on their parenting style. And, here's a good time, I think, to say that I like to distinguish parenting styles from a parenting approach. So when I think of styles, I think of extreme parenting or baby-led style versus parent-led style, routine, mm-hmm. for example, style. But through any style we choose, we can have that same approach of tuning into our own needs and getting help when we need it, tuning into our baby's needs, getting to know what they want from us or need from us and responding in a sensitive and warm way,
mm-hmm.
Loving them for who they are. Now, if we use that approach, there are so many styles available to us.
Mm-hmm. And so many styles we can use guilt-free. A lot
of
people talk about the way that one of the kind of the biggest barriers to parental well-being is actually that feeling of guilt.
Oh, yes.
We have
that feeling of guilt. And I also really had a good look at many of the themes that mothers come to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are so many reasons to feel guilty, aren't there? And one something that a lot of mothers talk about is the guilt around using pain relief analgesics during labour.
Oh, wow. Because you've got a whole section here on birth plans and birth and kind of how mums can navigate that. And that's one of the areas where we get a lot of guilt coming through.
Yeah, because there's a bit of a push, I guess. It's interesting because before modern obstetrics, of course, it was all about the safety of mothers and the safety of babies. But thankfully, now that we do have modern obstetrics, in the West at any rate, we have wonderful safety levels. You know, perinatal death, thank goodness, has dropped so significantly.
I mean, this used to be the most life-threatening time in any mother and baby's life, you know. And now, thank God, we're not in that position anymore.
Well, it's wonderful. And, you know, when I did look back at diaries, you know, diary entries that woman wrote, you know, back in time, worried that they were facing a death sentence on their due date.
Wow.
They're very moving to read, actually.
Yeah.
And I just want to put it out there that, of course, as everyone knows, in developing countries, this is still the case sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, that women die, that babies die frequently in childbirth. So thank goodness it's not like that here. Now, because of that shift from safety, we now look at the process of birth.
Because we have the luxury.
We have the luxury to look at the process of birth. And which, of course, is important because women really deserve to feel safe when they're given birth. Mm. And so many women do feel traumatised.
Do you get a lot of mothers who come to see you because they've had a traumatic or difficult birth experience?
Yeah.
And it has impacts later on for them as well?
It can have a real impact on not only their emotional health but their enjoyment of mothering. So now that, and you know, talking about birth plans, for example.
Yes.
Birth plans came about for a wonderful reason, which was in about the 50s, I think it was about the 50s, that birth plans really came about because women were being coaxed into doing some really unnecessary things during labour. You know, they were being knocked out.
Oh, my goodness.
So they were under. They were being shaved. They were being given enemas. And that was totally unnecessary. So thank goodness for birth plans back then, because women could say, I don't want to be under when I have my baby. I don't need an enema. Don't shave me. Now birth plans have taken a life of their own. I write some really, when I work in the public system, some really useful birth plans for women who might have emotional health difficulties, and so they need to perhaps have a room on their own for people to treat them sensitively. But birth plans, in a way, have taken a life of their own. And some of the things that I see aren't particularly helpful, such as women who have been coerced into not using pain relief because they're told that their baby might not bond as well as they would have, that it'll have physiological impacts on their babies. It's just not true.
Yeah.
It's absolutely not true. The APGAR scores are great, even if you've had pain relief often. And there's no reputable research to show that there are really any short or long-term effects in bonding or really anything else if you have pain relief while you give birth.
So your book actually is a really important myth buster for parents who might otherwise be experiencing guilt and anxiety.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fantastic. So for those who are listening and want to access a copy, Smart Mothering is out there. You can find Natalie Flynn's book in major bookstores. And if you want to hear this episode again, you can tune into Planet FM and join us next week at Radio Shalom. We would like to thank our sponsor, Nature Bee.